It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last year, the borough of Etna, a few miles north of the city, celebrated its 150th anniversary. Now, the river town of about 3,700 residents is celebrating its designation as the first eco-district in the world. Joining me in studio is Christine Mondor, founder of Evolve EA, a sustainable and green design firm. Welcome to The Confluence, Christine.
Thank you.
And Robert Tunyon is Etna Community Organization board member. Robert, welcome.
Thank you very much.
The annual Eco District Summit is a gathering of leaders focused on neighborhood sustainability. It's wrapping up in Pittsburgh today, at which Etna was honored. Christine, what's the purpose of the summit?
Yeah, so the summit, this is actually the 10th annual Eco District Summit, and the summit's taken place in all over the country, Boston, Portland, Minneapolis. This year, we're very pleased that the summit is here in Pittsburgh, and we have a couple hundred people from around the country who've come together to share stories about their communities. So we have professionals, we have community members, we have people who are invested in making cities better places. So we're pleased to host them.
I use the word eco district. So what's an eco district? What qualities are needed for certification?
An eco district is used not just for certified districts. So there are many communities here in Pittsburgh who have been working on eco district planning. Larmer was probably the earliest, and Uptown Eco Innovation District in the city. But in Etna's world, Millvale and Sharpsburg and Etna have been part of the Triborough Eco District. And so they've been on this journey for about 8-10 years. And so an eco district, oftentimes you think about your community as a place, your neighborhood as a place. And so eco districts create better places, more resilient and more sustainable. But it also looks at the processes in a community, like how we make and do things, how we share resources. And it also looks at the people and equity issues in a community and how we build will and how we work together.
So what is required for certification, though?
So certification. So while many of these communities here in Pittsburgh have been working on eco district planning principles, people across the country were also doing similar work. Out in Portland, they had been doing some work and said, we should kind of talk about this nationally. That's when ecodistricts.org convened the summits and created the eco districts protocol. The protocol is the certification standard. So a certified community has a kind of plan, and that plan commits to carbon neutrality, equity, and resilience. And they have to provide rigorous documentation in a couple areas. You need a declaration of collaboration and how you will work together. You have kind of imperatives that say these are the things that are important to us, like resource regeneration. And you have a roadmap, which is the way you get there.
Robert, your reaction to the certification?
Well, first of all, we were blown away. It was not something that we were knowingly going to receive. We were going through the process, and it was about bringing together our community, identifying what we want to work on together. And along the way, we started to enter the certification process with the Eco District's national organization. In September, we found out that we were the first community to have completed and submitted the roadmap, the third element that Christine mentioned. And it was at that time they said, well, we're going to be in Pittsburgh, and at that summit, it's likely that you will be the first certified eco district. And we were blown away. It has been such a beautiful process in our community. And then to have it be recognized on this level was certainly something special.
Christine used the word dedication. Give us an example of that, of the partners in Etna and yourself and the community board about dedication.
A couple of different ways to say that. The first is our borough, as a municipal government, we have great leaders in the community like Mary Ellen Ramage, Mayor Tom Rengers, and we have a great council. And these people have been working very hard for many years on these type of projects. So there is great dedication in our borough. When we started the eco district process, we have been doing this for about 3 years. And as a part of that process, many planning many planning processes in the city will have three meetings. We've had 35 free, open to the public events where people, residents, can have a say in what their community looks like. So when we talk about dedication, we have been committed to an equitable process where people can shape their own future.
Probably to be a little more specific, there are six areas that we've worked through in this process. There's water, energy, food, there's air quality, mobility, and equity. And so if you just say those things to somebody, they may not understand them or understand why they're important. And so the process really brings these ideas into relevance for people. And that's why the process has been getting it into every event is really important.
Our guests on The Confluence are Christine Mondor, founder of Evolve EA, a sustainable and green design firm, and Robert Tugnon, a community organization board member for Aetna, which has been certified as an eco district. So how long have you been working on the plan?
Well, the plan started about 3 years ago. It was in the winter of 2016 that we had the opportunity to connect with Millvale and Sharpsburg. And at that time, there was this idea of a multi-municipal collaboration where the three communities would share resources and knowledge, but they would collaborate with their own communities individually, independently, to make a plan for themselves. So in Aetna, like many initiatives, it started small. We met in a coffee shop. It was a cold winter night and 20 people came. And slowly over time, it grew in size, scale, and intensity. It has been a beautiful process where people have really come together. And it has been something where people that are relatively new to Aetna, like myself and my wife, have been able to sit alongside longstanding leaders in the community, learn what they know, and help contribute in a new way.
Mm-hmm. Christine, the importance of partnerships, whether it's residents and the businesses of that community or partnerships with other nearby municipalities.
Yeah, partnerships are essential to getting anything done. Certainly in Aetna, the business community has really come out in support, and the municipality, local government academy. I want to especially point out that the Triborough Eco District, of which Aetna is a part, Aetna, Sharpsburg, and Millvale, is really built on some early and foundational work that Brian Wolovich and others did in Millvale.
Who's Brian?
Brian is a how do you say this? He's a force of nature. he wears many hats, and he's a council person in Millvale, but he founded the Millvale Community Library. But most of all, he's really carried forth the spirit of eco districts in the Rivertown communities so that Aetna and Sharpsburg could kind of stand on those shoulders. And they, you know, have also are pursuing certification and partnered with Aetna early on so that when they got into their process, they really had some great things to stand on.
Aetna was cited for its commitment to green infrastructure and stormwater management. Creek overflows causing flooding of streets and businesses has long been a problem for Aetna. I remember a watermark along a building at the intersection with Maplewood Street, and it was there from, I think, the 36 flood. And then, of course, devastating flooding from Hurricane Ivan's remnants. What has been done in Aetna to address that so it helps with the stormwater management?
And the stormwater management has absolutely been a borough focus since Hurricane Ivan. And since then, the community started to gather with its northern suburbs, communities upstream from the watershed. So Aetna is located at the confluence of the Allegheny River and Pine Creek, and that puts us in a 67-square-mile watershed. We are 1 square mile of that. And so there are many places that the stormwater is coming from. So Aetna has been working on green infrastructure, what we can do in our own community. If you come to downtown Aetna, you will see a beautiful streetscape. There's a metal grate system that collects all of the downspouts from the downtown buildings. And instead of rushing that into the sewers, it slowly releases it at a time when it's not under so much pressure. And so we have been very active in that and other flood mitigation projects. And we've been lucky to have missed some of the more recent storm events. And we're very grateful and thankful to the borough for all of that they've done in terms of stormwater management.
Part of the Eco District plan is to kind of rethink the way that Aetna touches Pine Creek. And so there are a number of places that celebrate Pine Creek. When a creek floods all the time, you have to avoid it. But, you know, they've been so vigilant in having upstream communities do their part that there's a lot of hope that these places can really create an identity for Aetna as a Pine Creek amenity.
How do you celebrate?
Well, one of the places that we are very focused on, there are areas in the community that are hardscapes. And so one way that we celebrate it is through our streetscape. The second way is the more natural areas. So rather than have every edge on our water bank be hard, we actually have places like our Pine Creek Nature Trail where it can spill over in the needed event. And so we hope that more areas along our creek edge can become more natural. And that would be a form of celebrating it. A nature trail, a walking trail, a place for children to play when it's in its natural state.
And most people probably don't know when they come across the bridge that they're going right over Pine Creek. And right there is a place to have a park connection between Sharpsburg and Aetna that bring those two main streets together.
Christine, what was Evolve EA's role in the regional eco-district movement and specifically Aetna?
Yeah, so I think one of our biggest contributions to the eco-district movement is identifying ways that communities can plan for transformational change. And, you know, we like to say the race is really the prize. So planning is great, but and the plan is useful, but in the end of the day, it's just a document unless you're really intentional about how people come together to plan. So we work to do education early, and we did a whole year of that in Aetna, where we just talked about the issues and got people up to speed. And then you create the plan. What do we want to do? And then afterward, you're very intentional about the implementation in a way that the partnerships and the relationships that Aetna has built both in the borough with other boroughs and outside come together to deliver the results.
In achieving sustainable goals, is there a balance of some assistance maybe from the outside, whether it's state, federal help, plus a degree of self-determination?
So we wouldn't be able to do the things that we're doing now without outside help. We have had great partnership from the state, as well as the county. And
in advice, money, what?
In both. They are great partners and collaborators with the borough. We've also received great foundation support. So the Triborough Eco District received a $2.3 million grant from the Henry L. Hillman Foundation. That has funded a lot of our work, both in the planning, but while we've been planning, we've also been doing implementation projects. So that's been very vital so that people, while they're thinking and learning about the different eco district principles, the six quality of life issues that Christine mentioned, it has been vital to see things happening in the ground now as we're talking about them.
Give us an example of some of the things that you've been implementing in the meantime while this whole planning process has been going on.
Sure. In our community, we have a fantastic community garden. And one of the eco district principles that we work with is we build on the things that are already good in the community. So this place, the community garden, is a place where we get fresh food and we think about how we handle our waste streams. We also implemented a solar canopy there that's a car charging station, and it allows us to have light during the evening. One of the beautiful things that happened this past spring was that we had a cooking demonstration, a cooking class, where people who are knowledgeable, nutritionists, put on a presentation for us so that we could learn more.
Aside from the wonderful acknowledgement, the certification as an eco district, is there any financial assistance or continued help to actually achieve the goals in the plan?
So I would say that one of the benefits of doing the planning is that you align your goals in a way that you can be very targeted in finding resources for it. And so, you know, whether it's air quality and in the work that New Sun Rising has been coordinating for the tri-boroughs in doing citizen science and understanding the air qualities in the tri-boroughs, or whether it's packaging ideas for new open spaces along the creek and looking for ways to fund that, the plan puts those things in an order that it becomes easier to find that funding.
The plan is to be launched in December, correct, Robert?
That's very correct.
All right. So what's next for Aetna, Robert?
Right now, under construction in the borough is the Aetna Riverfront Park.
Oh.
Now, this is something very special because Aetna has not had a connection to its riverfront, what it's directly adjacent to, in 150 years. So this riverfront park will give us connection to the larger region by bike, by foot. I know that many people will be coming down to the riverfront to bike to a Pirates game in the near future. And so it is going to be a very special thing. The other piece, next month, we are launching a campaign to build a community library in Aetna. Now, that's something that we had in the community, but we lost after a flood. Right now, there is no true public space in Aetna. It is so essential that we start to provide educational resources and assets, programmings, and a place to launch the Aetna Eco District in the community. So we will be taking all of the effort that we and focus that we have been doing for the last 3 years and placing that into this new initiative to build the Aetna Community Library.
Christine Mondor is founder of Evolve EA, a sustainable and green design firm, and Robert Tugnon is community organizer, board member for Aetna, which has been certified as an eco district. Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for telling our story.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. Still ahead on The Confluence, the recent bankruptcy of Ohio Valley coal giant Murray Energy has tens of thousands of coal miners worried about an already shaky pension plan. Pittsburgh Public Schools is planning to reevaluate where students go to school after data showed a nearly 17% drop in enrollment over the last decade. And plastics pollution in the ocean has been a concern for years, but recently there's been a growing presence of plastic in Pennsylvania's rivers. More from this and past episodes of The Confluence are at wesa.fm/confluence. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Ohio Valley coal giant Murray Energy's bankruptcy has renewed fears about the already shaky pension plan that tens of thousands of retired miners depend upon. As Becca Schimmel reports, some regional lawmakers are renewing their push to fix the United Mine Worker Pension Fund.
Murray Energy is the last major employer contributing to the UMWA pension plan. In its bankruptcy filing, the company reports more than $8 billion in obligations under various pension and benefit plans. It's not yet clear if the bankruptcy court will relieve Murray's pension obligations, but UMWA spokesperson Phil Smith says if recent history is any guide, that's a likely outcome.
We don't think any company should be able to be relieved of its responsibilities to any retirees, whether in the coal industry or not. But it has happened in the coal industry time after time after time after time.
The UMWA Health and Retirement Plan was already in financial trouble. The industry's decline in production and a wave of bankruptcies made insolvency likely by 2022. UMWA President Cecil Roberts says bankruptcy courts contribute to that when companies walk away from debts.
They ran the company into ground. They get rich. The workers lose their health care. Sometimes they lose their jobs. Sometimes they lose their pensions. That needs to be dealt with.
Murray Energy is among nearly a dozen coal companies to go bankrupt during the Trump administration, despite the repeated claims of a coal comeback. Simon Hayter is an assistant professor of public policy at Penn State University. He says it would have been more manageable if Congress had addressed the inevitable issue much earlier.
Coal miners are one of those, you know, it's probably a worst-case scenario here because the balance between people paying into the system and people taken out of the system is so out of whack.
Hayter says it also raises the question of whether people can rely on these pension systems in the future. He says the decline in union membership and the complex actions of bankruptcy courts have given employers an edge over the interests of workers.
Bankruptcy law and bankruptcy court will certainly side with employers much more than they will side with employees.
West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin and other coal area Democrats introduced the American Miners Act to try to shore up the shaky pension. That bill would transfer some money from interest accrued on the Federal Abandoned Mine Land Fund, which is used to clean up old mining sites, into the mine workers' pension plan. Manchin wants to attach the act to a must-pass spending bill. He says pension checks are urgent for retirees and many widows who depend on that money for basic living expenses.
When coal companies go bankrupt, coal miners' benefit are the bottom of the priority list.
The bill does not yet have a Republican co-sponsor, but there is general bipartisan support for action on the miners' pensions, including a House bill proposed by Republican David McKinley of West Virginia. But of course, one congressional Republican's voice will matter most, and that is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky. In a statement, McConnell said he's concerned about the insolvency issues facing a number of pension plans and supports finding a bipartisan solution for pension reform. Some lawmakers worry that the faltering miners' pension could cause a domino effect for other multi-employer pension plans. Last year, a bipartisan group of lawmakers formed a committee to address pension problems affecting a range of workers. Ohio Republican Senator Rob Portman warned at a field hearing last year that if even one of the larger plans becomes insolvent, that could create a broader risk.
That wave of bankruptcy has the potential to create an economic contagion effect. In other words, it would spread around our economy.
But the committee disbanded without any clear solutions. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Becca Schimmel in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A new census will be taken next year, and we'll find out if the city's population has declined. But Pittsburgh Public Schools officials know their student enrollment has dipped. A new report out yesterday shows a 17% drop over the last 10 years. WESA's education reporter Sarah Schneider has been following, and she joins us now. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Kevin.
So, Sarah, were board members aware of this data prior to last evening's meeting, and what was their reaction?
Sure. Well, we get enrollment numbers every October for every school district in the state, so they know that this number was coming. What happened, though, is the board commissioned this report almost 2 years ago. So there have been a lot of conversations for the last 2 years of what this could look like, because this report was really projecting out the next 10 years of what the district could expect enrollment to look like by school, really. And so
by school.
It was really interesting to look at, you know, if the kindergarten grade is bigger this year, it might shrink it by fifth grade. They're really looking at school by school for their strategic plan, right? Superintendent Anthony Hamlet came on a few years ago and created the strategic plan. This is part of that process to figure out how to align schools to make sure that every public school is serving the students in that area.
So before we look a little more ahead, why the decline? Did the report spell that out?
Sure. There's a combination of, you know, birth rates are down in Pittsburgh. Birth rate is calculated by the mother's residency. So if a child is born in Pittsburgh, they're calculating out 5 years from now, they expect that child to be in Pittsburgh for kindergarten. So that has been down. That shifts population quite a bit. Charter school enrollment is slightly increased. And so that looks different year to year, but it is a slight increase in Pittsburgh. Other than that, though, this report really didn't look at necessarily why it's down, but we just know it's down and it projected out if the trends continue, what that'll look like.
Do we know how many left the city to find different, better, maybe schools in the suburbs or private systems?
Sure. I mean, again, this wasn't really a survey of families, which I think some board members were frustrated with, because we hear all these anecdotes of families, you know, once your child reaches fifth grade, they leave for the suburbs for a bigger public school district or for whatever reason. And that is not what this report was. It was really just looking at the numbers that we have and projecting out what it will look like. Again, there was some frustration last night.
By whom?
A couple board members just asked, you know, why this wasn't in there. And that doesn't seem to be the work that the district is taking on right now. They're not going to survey families who have left to find out why they're leaving. They just know they're going to focus on the students they do have and that they expect to have for the next 10 years.
Right. I mean, there are certain things you can do, maybe try to address. You can't address the birth rate, but you might be able to address people leaving the district, trying to encourage them to stay.
Sure. So this is going to be 6 months of community involvement. They, at the end of this 6 month process, the district wants to have a strategic plan moving forward that will help align schools. And so there will be a lot of community feedback in this process. I'm really excited and interested to hear what that will be in the next 6 months. So I think that's where people can weigh in that, like, where our priorities should be. Should the priority be to focus on the students that are captured right now in Pittsburgh Public Schools, or to win back families that have left?
Will this input be over the course of the 6 months, or one or two quick meetings?
They haven't put out a schedule yet of when the meetings will start. We expect them to begin in December. The report to the board is expected in May. So if we look at the strategic planning process, it involved a lot of community meetings at local schools.
Mm-hmm. Does this mean that more school buildings could close? Could it even change the feeder patterns, how the district decides which school students ultimately attend?
Yeah, I think there's going to be a lot of fear about that and a lot of concern of what will happen to our school. You know, people buy houses in certain neighborhoods so they can go to certain schools. And that will be a conversation in the next 6 months. You know, there are some schools that have to be addressed. Colfax, for one, is an elementary school in Squirrel Hill that is near capacity. They've had conversations about opening classrooms in the basement. So that's a conversation that has to happen in the next 6 months. District officials have told me that will be part of this process of figuring out what's going to happen there, while there are some schools on the north side that are only at half capacity. So it's clear that the district is spread a little thin. They're not saying what's going to happen. When I say they, I mean district officials, because they do want this to be an open process involving the community. So it's really unclear right now what this process will even look like. But I think feeder patterns will be addressed. That has been said many times.
Sarah Schneier is WESA's education reporter. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As Shell Chemical builds a new plastics production plant in Beaver County, there's been anger around the world over increasing plastic pollution in the oceans. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant met up with one researcher who's studying plastic waste, not in the oceans, but in Pennsylvania's rivers, and is pushing for solutions.
It's a chilly morning, 7:45 a.m., and Penn State chemistry professor Sherry Mason and one of her students collect trash from Mill Creek in Erie, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, don't fall in. The chip bag, do you see it? The Cheeto bag?
There's a boom across the creek that catches debris. The trash gets pushed by the river and the wind into a cement containment area. A few times a week at the same time of day, Mason and her students show up with a large rake and pull up whatever they find. An iced tea bottle, beer can, cigarette butts.
Oh, and there's a for cigars. Do you see the wrapper?
The trash is placed in a bin. Mason says after collecting here or at a second research site at Cascade Creek, they take it to the lab and lay it out to dry on screens. Students will sort it and input data about each piece. What product it is, the material, the type of container.
What you'll notice is that vast majority of it is either styrofoam or bottles. It's a lot of plastic bottles.
Mason has already researched plastics in the Great Lakes.
What we see out there is really, really small.
Plastic doesn't go away, but it does break down. One bottle can degrade into hundreds, even thousands of tiny pieces of plastic the size of a grain of sand. They can be eaten by birds or fish. The impact on human health is still unknown. More and more local governments are considering banning plastic bags and other single-use plastics. Mason wants to have data for leaders to make more informed decisions.
When I stand in front of policymakers, they're like, well, how much of it comes from bags? How much of it comes from bottles? And I can't answer that question. And so I wanted to move upstream and look at bigger items.
Mason wants to find out how much plastic is flowing from the rivers to the Great Lakes and how it's affected by the rainfall, season, and economics of local communities. She's hoping to correlate what's pulled out of the rivers with what's collected in beach cleanups. And she's pushing for solutions.
So if you want to solve a litter problem, to me, a good starting point is policies that ban styrofoam and at least put fees on bottles so that then they're collected.
In Pennsylvania, the legislature has put a moratorium on municipal regulation of plastics. But still, some cities, including Philadelphia, are considering bans. Keith Christman says plastic bans are not the answer because plastic is needed for things like medical devices, cars, and keeping food fresh.
Plastic plays a very important role to society.
Chrisman is director of plastics markets for the American Chemistry Council, a trade group that supports the plastic industry. He says, like any trash, plastic in the environment is a problem.
The solution to this challenge is to improve our collection, recycling, and recovery of plastics and other materials.
Chrisman's group has a goal of recycling all plastic packaging in the U.S. by 2040. Judith Enck, founder of the nonprofit Beyond Plastics, supports a different goal, produce less plastic.
And it's an issue that gets worse every single day, especially when it rains hard and you have all these storm sewers. Basically, you know, they're delivery devices to get plastics into the water.
Half of all plastic in the world was made in the last 13 years, and more is being produced all the time. In Beaver County, Pennsylvania, Shell Chemical is building a $6 billion plant that will take ethane from natural gas and convert it to plastic. It's expected to produce 1.6 million tons of plastic pellets each year. More plants like this are under consideration in the region.
And the plastic makers and the fossil fuel companies would have us believe that there's no problem producing vast amounts of plastic because you can recycle it all. That's simply not true. Plastic recycling has been an abject failure.
According to the EPA, the highest recycling rate ever achieved for plastics in the U.S. is 9.5%, and many city recycling programs across the country are collapsing. China has stopped accepting plastic waste from the U.S. for recycling. There's little market for recyclables, and the costs are skyrocketing. Penn State's Sherry Mason wants product manufacturers to help create that market for recycled plastic. As she talks by Mill Creek, more waste collects in the containment area.
We have four more things that have blown in here. So that Dasani, the liquor bottle, the Dunkin' Donuts, and then there's another bottle of water. I can't see the brand on that one. I'm very interested in the brands.
There's been a focus on brands since a report last year by the environmental group Greenpeace. It found Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and Nestle were the world's biggest producers of this plastic trash. While many bottle labels say, please recycle, Mason says these companies need to take responsibility for their packaging.
So you can't say that you want people to recycle and then use very little post-consumer plastic in your product. It's only a recycling process if people are using it at the other end. And if the companies who make the bottles aren't actually using it, then who else is?
Some brands say they are taking action to use more recycled plastic. In a press conference just this week, Coke, Pepsi, and Keurig Dr. Pepper, maker of single-use coffee pods, announced a joint recycling initiative.
We're coming together across industry with a laser focus.
This is Catherine Luger, president of the American Beverage Association, a trade group.
To reclaim our plastic bottles so that they can be remade into new bottles, reducing our use of new plastic.
Luger says companies will be pushing to recover more plastic bottles and jointly investing $400 million to improve recycling systems in four parts of the country, which are yet to be announced. Sherry Mason says this is one move to correct course on the problem of single-use plastics, but the solution will be multifaceted and will mean a change in the way people think.
It's getting people to realize that our disposable culture is having an impact all throughout the chain. And what kind of society do we really want?
As that question is being pondered by people around the world, many still hope that this region will become a major center of plastics production for decades to come. Julie Grant, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. The polls are open this election day and will remain so until 8 o'clock tonight. What are the key races to look for on the ballot? What might you need to research just a bit before heading to your polling place? We're going to put those questions and more to Chris Potter, the editor of WESA's Government Accountability Team. Chris joins us from home. You're in for a long night, huh, Chris?
Yeah, I don't think of this as home so much as our field election coverage office, Kevin.
All right, Chris.
Join me by phone in any case.
Okay. Before we get to some of the contested races, the usual process is to certify results about 2 weeks after Election Day, but we might not know the results of one statewide ballot question anytime soon. Why is that?
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, we may know the results. We won't really know the outcome, if that makes any sense. The state Supreme Court on Monday, we're talking about Marcy's Law, which is a proposed constitutional amendment that would put victims' rights, as they're called, into the state constitution, requiring that crime victims get advance notice of court proceedings, get a chance to address the court, things like that. Very controversial bill because of concerns about what it might mean for the rights of the accused. And yesterday, the state Supreme Court said, hey, we are not sure this is constitutional, that this ballot question itself is problematic. So we are telling the state, the Department of State, to hold off on tabulating or certifying the results of the vote in this particular contest until we have a chance to adjudicate the legal issues brought before us.
Okay. It's an off-year election, municipal, county contest. What sort of turnout are local officials expecting?
Yeah, I spoke to the county about this yesterday, and they said about 27%. That's not a lot. It's also not out of the general range when we're talking about an off-year election. But what is sort of unusual is for those hardy few who do show up to vote, there are more choices than we're used to getting, at least here in Democratic-controlled Allegheny County in an off-year general election.
Usually the election for the highest-ranking office is the marquee race, in this case for Allegheny County Executive. But is that true today?
Yeah, no, this is Rich Fitzgerald does have, he's the Allegheny County Executive. He does have a Republican challenger, Matt Drozd. But the real interest is in the district attorney's race, down ballot a little bit, where two-decade-long incumbent Steve Zappala is facing an independent challenger in Lisa Middleman. It's been a race we at WESA have been watching very closely. Both sides have raised about the same amount of money. I went voting earlier today. Both operations had people in the field working the polls. So this is definitely the one to watch on the county level.
And Rich Fitzgerald is trying for an unprecedented third term, as is County Controller Chelsea Wagner. But she has some competition as well.
Yeah, that's right. Chelsea Wagner is facing a Republican named Brookna Donley, whose name might not be familiar to people, in part even Republicans, because they didn't see it on the ballot in May. She basically got the nomination as a result of a write-in effort that was backed by the county. And essentially, the Republican Committee of Allegheny County tried to kind of rush her on the ballot once Ms. Wagner had some legal trouble in Detroit, an altercation with Detroit police. Republicans thought they had an opportunity to jump in here and maybe score some points. We have not really heard much from either Ms. Donley nor Mr. Drozd since they got onto the ballot. And so if you were a betting person, I think you'd have to say the incumbents will carry the day, but we'll see.
Right. Just about 30 seconds or so, Chris. There are judges on the ballot for Common Pleas Court. They are retention elections. It's a straight up or down yes or no. Do you want to keep them on the bench is the question, basically. Is there a good source, you know, where voters can examine judges' rulings?
Yeah, so the Allegheny County Bar Association is generally where folks look, and the ACBA, you can go onto their website, which is acba.org, or you can trust me when I tell you that the Bar Association has recommended all 12 of the county common pleas judges up for retention. They've suggested that voters give them the thumbs up and give them another 10-year stint as judges of the Court of Common Pleas.
And, of course, there is a ballot question for City of Pittsburgh voters. Parks Conservancy asking voters for more money to address a backlog of maintenance and improvement projects. Chris Potter is WESA's political editor. Chris, we'll see you back here tomorrow.
You'll see me before then, but thanks a lot.
Okay. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, we will have an analysis of the results of today's election. What's the impact for residents at the community and county levels? And do those results send a message for next year's contest? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.